The National Audubon Society will mark its 100th anniversary next year, but the celebration began early with this month's issue of Audubon magazine. In it, environmental historian Jennifer Price describes the pioneer activists who led the fight to save endangered bird species by stopping the feather trade. Jennifer Price joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Can you set the scene for us? Say it's 1890. Give us an overview of the feather trade industry and the general state of the bird population in the U.S.
Sure. Well, the Audubon Society actually gets started in 1896 to fight the feather trade. And the feather trade has been, the feather fashions have been essentially cycling in and out of fashion since, well, they're reputed to have been started by Marie Antoinette. I mean, this is just a legend, a court legend, I guess. She sticks a feather in her hat and she sparks this craze that becomes so out of hand that women have their hair and their hats piled so high with feathers and fruit and flowers that they actually can't fit into their carriages and they have to lean their heads out of the carriage windows as they're driven from place to place.
Okay, so she sets off this craze.
So then these fashions, you're wearing birds on your head, dead birds on women's heads, essentially, cycle in and out of fashion for the
next.
There
were entire birds as well. We're not just talking birds.
Yes, yeah. You know, on one hat, you might have an owl's head, an eagle feather, an egret plume. You can see as many as 8 or 10 whole warblers arranged artfully around a single hat. They'll have a hummingbird actually feeding the baby hummingbirds in a nest, like this little diorama of natural history atop your head. One of the most popular whole bird fashions was to take an entire tern, which is a fairly large bird, and they would lay it over the hat and it would sort of spill over, and then the head would be pointing down towards the woman's face.
So this is generating a feather trade industry.
Yes, and what happens is in the late 19th century, this craze really gets out of hand, and it's creating serious population declines in species across North America. There are certain birds, like a number of egret species, that basically get shot down to nothing. Some of those recover. There are still some species, like roseate spoonbills, reddish egrets, a few more, that still exist only in very small numbers, and that dates back to the devastations of the feather trade.
In your article, you have this great line here. You write how the Audubon Society had its origins in Boston in 1896. Mrs. Augustus Hemingway read a description of the bloody hunts at the egret rookeries and immediately called her cousin Miss Minnehall to tea. Now, I want to ask about the teas in a minute, but first tell us about those bloody egret hunts.
Egrets, snowy and great white egrets, have these gorgeous, long, soft, beautiful white feathers that they grow only during mating season. They're mating feathers. And so the way the plume hunters get them, and they're very, very popular, they go down into South Florida where the colonies are, and they wait until the baby egrets are hatched, because the parent egrets that's when they're least likely to flee. And then they shoot the parent egrets. It's a very bloody scene. It's a bloody mess. They rip these feathers off of their backs, and they leave the parents to, you know, die on the ground, and then the baby egrets starve in the nests. Now, this may sound horrible to us now, but if you're a woman or a man in the 1890s who adheres to kind of Victorian family norms and Victorian gender roles, this was just horrifying, and this becomes the story that gets... And in fact, it's the story that provokes Mrs. Augustus Hemingway, who forms the first Audubon Society, is because she reads an account of the egret massacre, and that's what promotes her to call her cousin to come to tea and talk about this and figure out what they can do about it.
Tell me about these teas. It was very much a cause rallied by women over
yes.
tea.
Yeah, well, these teas are actually very, you know, I tend to think of teas as kind of trivial events, like women are just talking about fashions or whatever. But in the 1890s, you had this very powerful, effective network of social reform groups. It was the women's club movement. The women's clubs had started earlier. They had their roots in abolition and temperance earlier in the century. And the women's clubs are at the peak of their power, exactly when the Audubon societies are forming. And they're working on a great many really important issues. And what happens is this issue is defined as a women's issue because women, it's the only issue in which women are so visible as culprits.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and it plugs right into this sense that women are supposed to be the morally superior half in Victorian society. This is the 1890s, and it becomes a very practical issue to be able to reform.
These state Audubon societies did then have an effect on a national scale.
Yes, they're very effective. Well, I mean, once these women get involved, and I should say there are men involved as well, but it's mostly a few prominent ornithologists. The memberships are about 80% women, and women are doing almost all the organizing work. And once they get involved, everything happens very, very fast. They essentially organize very effectively. It becomes really the first national mass grassroots environmental organization. And within 4 years, they've passed, not they, but they have managed to provide the public support that's necessary to pass the first federal wildlife legislation measure, which is the Lacey Act, in 1900. And that then the Lacey Act significantly stops the feather trade in 1900. It's not until about another decade that they fully stop the plume trade.
Jennifer Price is a freelance writer and a research scholar at the UCLA Center for the Study of Women. Thank you so much.
Thank you.